Team GP Perspectives. Peer-to-peer conversations digging into everything and anything general practice. Brought to you by the RCGP. This week, we've got three amazing guests talking a little bit about well-being. What does well-being mean to each of them? And some of their practical tips on how to support yourselves and other colleagues in challenging times. Please be aware, this episode contains mention of child abuse and suicidal thoughts.
Hi, I'm Tesh, and I'm a GP based in London in Chelsea and Canary Wharf. And I have an interest in mental health and general well-being, and I work as an ambassador for a mental health charity for doctors called UAK Doc.
I'm Carter Singh. I am a GP partner in Nottinghamshire. Been a partner for about 10 years now in my current practice, and I also am a faculty rep for the Vale of Trent faculty on the National Council for the RCGP. I'm also on the Governance and Nomination Committee for the RCGP, and I'm also the Vice Chairman for the Nottinghamshire Local Medical Committee. So I wear a number of different hats, and I try not to wear the same hat at the same time and different hats at the same time as well. So, yeah, that's just a bit about me in a nutshell, really.
Hi, I'm Zerva. I'm a GP in the North Staffordshire area of the West Midlands. I qualified as a GP just under 2 years ago, but I've tried to keep myself busy in other ways as well. So I am the RCGP College Tutor for the West Midland faculty. I have recently started working with the British Islamic Medical Association, which I think really complements sort of my kind of my faith and also my practice as a doctor. I have a social media page, which I started up about a year ago, which is how I connected with Tesh. I feel slightly starstruck by having Carter on this, you know, because Carter's achieved quite a lot. And it's really nice to like actually be in the presence of people that have done quite a lot for minority communities, because that's what you got your OBE for, wasn't it?
Thank you.
For the work that you did.
Your words are too kind. And I honestly, I don't put myself on a pedestal or anyone else on a pedestal. We do our best, don't we? I think we just try to do our little bit. And if that little bit is, you know, bigger than what we've done in the past, so be it. If it's not, it's the contribution, isn't it, that we make. And yeah. I bet you've contributed way more than me, and your recognition is still
not sure about that, but I suppose it's when you see people like yourself who do wonderful things for especially our minority communities, it inspires people that come after you or people that get to know more about you to do the same. So like in our area, for example, vaccine hesitancy, just like in most other areas, is huge amongst ethnic minorities. So I set up like a brief educational program for that.
Well-being to me means an overall sense of contentment. So just for a start, just recognizing where you are. There's a really good way of kind of rating your day that that a doctor called Beth told me, which is, you kind of come home and you score your day from 1 to 10, and 1 is like not a very good day and 10 is an excellent day. So I think an awareness of how you're feeling and how you're doing is a big part of well-being. And it seems really straightforward, but it's not something that we're taught. It's not something that we naturally are kind of guided to do. It's something you learn almost once you've been burnt out and you've struggled. That's what I've noticed. A lot of people start learning about these things once they've hit a point where they're really struggling. And so I think it's really good for us to be opening conversations where we educate people to see how they're doing and become aware early on before struggling begins or before it becomes a really massive issue or turns into something that provokes a mental health episode or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, Tesh, building on what you've just said, I think only when you lose something, perhaps, or haven't got it, do you appreciate the value of it when you're actually trying to define it. So when I was thinking about well-being, I find it really difficult to kind of give like a one-line answer. And I thought back to, I mean, during my childhood, I unfortunately experienced a lot of abuse. And you know, when I was growing up from birth to the age of about 14, you know, I was pretty badly abused in many ways. The way we learn about safeguarding in our professions, you choose any category of abuse, I've probably had it. And when I was backed against the ropes and I was in a corner and I was at my lowest ebb and I was just literally grounded on the floor, you know, thinking about ending it all at one point when I was not even a teenager, that's when really I started to kind of reframe things and turn negatives into positives. And if there was 1,000 of me identical in the same given conditions, I reckon 999 of them probably would have ended up dead or in prison. So I think for me it was random. There's nothing that I did specifically which was special. For me it was pretty random. And I now, when I think about well-being, think back to the dark times, the bad times, and kind of, if I'm a systems guy, so I always kind of break definitions down into categories. So I would kind of categorize well-being in terms of the quality of the relationships that you have with other people, a kind of level of connection you have with people, whether it be emotional, sharing experiences with people at the end of your day, perhaps, or during work hours. Learning. I'm always on a journey where every day is a school day for me. I'm always learning new things. My son taught me that bananas are a herb today. I didn't know that. Random little tidbits like that, you pick up. Giving, random acts of kindness, which, spans across all religions and all faiths, trying to do things out of kindness for people. You get so much satisfaction and fulfillment from doing that. And also, we've got this term, haven't we, that has become really popular in the years gone by, mindfulness. Talking, I know it's become a bit of a corny and a bit of a trendy term, which sometimes we cringe at when we hear it. But, focusing on the here and now, really squeezing every last bit of juice out of now and the present, rather than focusing too much on what's happened in the past and worrying too much about what's going to happen in the future. Obviously, you've got to be guided and learn lessons and reflect on the past so it can guide your future, but not dwelling on it too much. And so that's how I'd kind of, not in a nutshell, the anti-nutshell definition of well-being is how I would kind of describe what I find useful to think about when it comes to well-being.
I think both those definitions are so good. I suppose I wouldn't really have an awful lot to add to that. I mean, well-being, like Tesh said, as a medical student, I don't remember any conversation with anyone who ever asked you how you should look after yourself, ever, ever, ever. It was always about how can you make yourself a better doctor? How can you make yourself better for your patients? How can you make yourself better for your colleagues? Like, the problem is you. You're the one who needs to do all of that for everybody else. And okay, being selfless is like, it's part of who all of us are, because we can't be doctors if we're not selfless. We can't be doctors if we don't care about our patients. And to some extent, to a great extent, I think most of us have probably put our patients before we've put ourselves. For me, well-being, it's funny, some of what Carter has mentioned about childhood and stuff has really resonated with me, because I suppose subconsciously, well-being has always been a part of, the state of being well, whether that's mentally well, physically well, that's inherent in all of us. I was also abused at the end of racist abuse, etc., as a child, and I was always in a predominantly white area. So for me to try and kind of be human and get through all of that, I suppose you have to have a certain state of well-being and certain coping mechanisms. So things that you would move yourself away from those stressful situations to try and manage. And because I was bullied, I didn't really have friends, so I couldn't share things, but I couldn't make those friends come out of thin air. So I'd have to try and cope in my own sort of way. And my parents were instrumental in really, really helping me kind of find that state of well-being. So they encouraged me with things that I really liked. So, I liked being outdoors. I liked doing music. I liked connecting with my faith. I liked connecting with people that were good for me. And I suppose, like Carter said, some of that's probably already in us. The next time I really consciously thought about well-being was when COVID started. Because COVID as a whole phenomenon in the whole world has been devastating, and it's not normal circumstances at all for any of us. And for us to have had to cope through all of that, survive to the end. I don't know when the end is coming, but I hope it's soon. And also living through the crap that we're dealing with as GPs as well. You know, the NHS has always been at the end of abuse, but okay, GPs really are at the end of abuse, have always been at the end of the abuse, and it's just becoming worse. So, you know, to have strong mechanisms in ways that you can deal with that is important, so that, for example, like Tesh said, we don't burn out. Again, not a very nutshelly summary of it.
From an employer point of view, in general practices, it's important that we look and see who's staying too late or coming in too early. I know that sounds like a really basic thing. I'm not a partner in a surgery. I've chosen to kind of go for the salaried / locum route myself. But what I notice is that practices that function well, they are looking to see whether their staff are actually coming in really, really early. So I've been at practices where some salaried doctors will come in at before 6 in the morning and they will leave about 7 or 8 at night, and that is a warning sign. If you're working more than a third your day, then that's scheduled. That should be recognised and something done about it, like urgently. And that will have a knock-on effect on staff retention as well, because one of the reasons is that a lot of GP practices are kind of lacking staff, and the staff who are there pick up the slack. And that does go to the partners as well. They're there from really early till really late. You've got to recognise if your staff are doing that. And then even if you are short staffed, you've got to find a way to get around that, because otherwise you'll lose those precious few staff that you have. And I see it happen over and over again, even in really kind of previously well-run practices. So I think that's a really key thing to look at.
I think, Tesh, what you've touched on is really, really important. So we've got a lot of telltale signs around us, and it's, you know, I remember when I was an SHO in hospital, and there was an F1 who was there at 8 o'clock. She bleeped me and she asked me to do a routine task for her. And I was like, one, you don't need to do that at this time of the day. Secondly, why on earth are you still here? Because she should have finished at 5 o'clock. And I don't think many people ask that question to each other. So, like you said, you know, if you can see any telltale signs, just ask, have that conversation with them. Don't ignore it. And if people are doing it persistently, because as we mentioned before, being a doctor and stuff, you become quite selfless. You don't always think about yourself. You think about what needs to be done. And a lot of us are type A personalities, perfectionists. You know, we like to do our job properly before we go home. That can lead, and it leads many of us to burning out, because we don't naturally draw that line so easily. So it's not as easy as we have a clock in and clock out card, although that'd be really nice. I'd love that. You know, clock in at 9 o'clock, clock out at 5, doesn't matter what's left, you know, someone else will pick it up. But that doesn't happen, especially in general practice. I think it's really important to look out for the staff that you're working with as well, because as a GP, you know what your workload is like. But chances are the nurses have got a workload similar to that, and so do your admin staff. And if you work in a surgery where you make it all about you and you don't look at them, then it's a dysfunctional system. You need to be looking out for them. So I work on a few sites where I'm the sole GP. I make it a priority that I go out at least twice in the morning and twice in the afternoon to make sure everybody else is okay. It might just be a 30-second. It's a nice break for me because I need a detachment from my room. But I go out and just make sure everyone's okay. You know, everyone's had a break. We all have our lunch together as well. Obviously, you need one receptionist to kind of man the reception when everyone else is having lunch. But it just means that you have that physical distance from your workplace. Lots of GPs have kind of unhealthy habits where they will sit and they will work and they will eat and they'll do everything in their room and they don't see anybody else. And they're just kind of feeding that kind of isolation cycle.
I'm going to take a step back. And I'm not going to teach my grandma how to suck eggs or give you a blow-by-blow account of practical steps you can take, you know, practice level, because ultimately that'll depend on your practice, your patient cohort, your demographics, loads of other factors. I think the thing we have to understand, as you both said, is that we are so good at protecting patients and put them at the center of everything that we do, and we're very patient centric, which is fantastic, and that should continue. However, we should also protect and look after ourselves. And they're not mutually exclusive. You know, you can do both. And if we don't look after ourselves, how can we look after our patients? And a survey that had been done, it was published in the BJGP. And don't quote me, but it was something along the lines of, if you've got, in terms of hours, the more hours you work and the more admin duties you kind of get wrapped around your neck, the higher the rating of anxiety, depression, even psychotic features in GPs were noted in that study. And these are nothing surprising. These facts don't come as any surprise to us. We live, breathe, eat and sleep general practice, you know, all three of us do. And so what I would say is that, look, there's things you can do on an individual basis. There's things you can do on a practice level. And there are our GP representatives and negotiators belonging to organizations who can negotiate and debate on our behalf at governmental levels. But notwithstanding the practical steps that can be taken at those levels, you know, we've got to look at our locus of control. So, for example, I used to worry a lot about the things I couldn't control. And that used to kind of take up a lot of my day, you know, about, you know, certain things. And then I started looking inwards and being a bit more reflective and introspective and started thinking about, hang on a minute, I can't directly influence, you know, whether or not the currency changes, you know, affect my stock value or whether or not someone launches nukes against other countries. That's outside of my control. I can't worry about that. Let's focus on what I can change and what I can control. And when I made that kind of paradigm shift in my own mind, that did help free up a lot of bandwidth, which I could then use to kind of influence things which were directly under my control. And I think it was Shakespeare who said that nothing is good or bad. Thinking makes it so. So it's not about the environmental constraints so much. It's about how you process that and process any or challenge any negative automatic thoughts which enter your mind and kind of, as I said before, turn negatives into positives. And, you know, we all, I think, need to do that to a certain extent. But ultimately, you know, your peer group, your family, your friends, your support network are so important in that process. And, you know, shouldn't be belittled, and a very important part of that whole well-being process.
I really think feeling valued whilst being a member of the RCGP is incredibly important, whether you have a role, you know, with a particular faculty board or not. And speaking from personal experience, towards the earlier part of my training, I really didn't feel like I had a place. I was part of the faculty board, but unfortunately didn't feel like I sort of belonged. I didn't feel listened to. And because of that, I became quite distant from what the RCGP was doing. When there was a post that I applied for, which is being the one of the college tutors for the West Midlands, the role is what essentially attracted me to applying, as opposed to for the RCGP necessarily. However, representation really matters. So I had said to myself that, look, you know, if you want the college to represent you, you need to be part of that faculty board as well, which is why I applied for it. And I was pleasantly surprised. The team that I work with are incredibly accommodating. They really value me. They really value the feedback members give at the end of events and things. One of the things that I've done, I suppose, in my role is we had a whole well-being series that wasn't just for Midland faculty, but we opened it out for everybody else. And that was because it was a constant thing that was feedback that was coming up in events. Our faculty in particular have been very proactive with arranging events to celebrate other cultures, other heritages and things like that. So I definitely think that there are voices there. That there are more voices being heard, and I think since I've been part of the faculty board, it's become so much more diverse, and 100% that has improved aspects of my well-being, because I feel like I am valued. There is meaning behind what I'm doing with the college,
So yes, I do think that the RCGP can play a big role in the well-being of, you know, both its members and who it represents.
One thing about the West Midlands, I'm sure it's similar in the East Midlands, is if you are a peripheral area, pre-COVID, people didn't necessarily feel engaged, which is one of the reasons why I was recruited, to try and improve engagement in our areas. But now since COVID has come along and everything's virtual, it means that, you know, I'm not having to travel an hour and a bit to get to Birmingham to go for a meeting. I can log on online. Similarly, people from the south part of the West Midlands.
It's really interesting, Zerva, because a lot of people have said similar things to what you said, and that's because they didn't have any feeling or sense of belonging to a certain board or a group or a faculty when they walked through the door. They just kind of, if they didn't turn off, anything that they did say kind of wasn't listened to or it wasn't acted upon. And that's a big thing that I hear. And the other thing is that there is that kind of assumption that it's the old guard, it's the old boys club, and, you know, it doesn't represent the membership. And that, when I mean it, I mean faculties, college boards, college officers. And that's a big criticism which has been thrown at the college recently in terms of diversity and inclusivity. And I think it was a massive stride forward when last time, when the council elections happened, nationally elected councils, I think all six or seven were females and they were from ethnic minority groups, which was such a nice thing to see. And it was such a giant leap forward for, you know, equality. And I think that's the direction of travel for the college, definitely. And look, if you look at the NHS, and it's made up of 40%+ of people belonging to ethnic minority groups, then why shouldn't the upper echelons of the boards and the faculties look like that makeup? Because ultimately, you know, if that's not the case, is it because there are barriers for applicants who are applying to get onto these positions? Or is it the fact that there is the applicants there, but they're just not making it through because the interview panels or the boards are the ones who are self-selecting people who look like them, speak like them, dress like them. And it, so it becomes like cronyism. So that is something I think definitely the college is looking to address, and I think it's actively addressing. I've been sitting on two task and finish groups. One is the Black and Asian minority group, and the other one is the EDI, Equality, Diversity and Inclusivity group. And I think we are making progress. But I think going back historically, you're either the kind of BMA, GPC camp, unionist camp in general practice, and you were lobbying the government as part of the GPC, or you were the college person who was the education and training kind of person, and never should the two camps meet. And I think the lines have definitely blurred over the years, where I don't think one organization has to do one thing and the other do another. I think the lines are blurring and it's not as black and white as it was before. So I think the college has definitely got a role in advocacy for mental health, but at the same time being a proponent for general practice at a governmental level. And I know that, you know, Martin Marshall, Helen Stokes Lampard before him, et cetera, always have their regular meetings with the ministers, their advisors, the special advisors for health to the government, and really do lobby on behalf of the profession, on behalf of the profession. And I do honestly believe that the college is becoming more activist in terms of standing up for the rights and the well-being of GPs, and the lines are blurring between, you know, organisations like the BMA and the college. There are loads of things. There's something called the GPS locally, which is like practitioner health, where we can anonymously contact them and they provide you with free sessions of counselling. There is practitioner health, which I think Claire Gerarda heads up, along with one of my colleagues, Helen Garth from Nottinghamshire. She's gone into that organisation recently. And there's loads of different things out there for support for GPs. But I think from an organisational and structural level, that the college is becoming more vocal. And I think that oft, you know, used quote from Monty Python, what did the Romans ever do for us? What has the college ever done for us? What do we get for our membership fee? Does it go to anything other than stocking the wine cellars at the college, which is a big myth? You know, what do we get for our money? And I think the college is definitely, you know, providing more transparency as to what they provide and what representation and lobbying that they do for and behalf of the profession. And I think that's only increasing. And I think, you know, long may it continue. And the more kind of ground up input that we provide into it, the more shop floor, coal-faced GPs that sit on the council, feed into the faculties, the more successful that's going to become. So I'm all for kind of grassroots level involvement to make the college more inclusive and provide more value for money for the fee paying members and fellows.
I think that's really important to just like link back in with well-being as well, because, you know, if the people on the shop floor actually have influence, you know, and have you know, what they say and what they feel, you know, including well-being, you know, these things all feed back to well-being. If you feel like you're valued by your employer or by the institution that you're meant to be part of, everyone wants to be part of the RCGP. A lot of people probably wish, I'm sure if we surveyed members that have left, I think everyone would have wanted to have stayed if they felt like they had a part, as you know, they felt like they had a role. And that 100% feeds into well-being, because if you don't belong to any institution, and there are some GPs that are not BMA members, they are not RCGP members, and they are having a crap time, but they have nowhere to turn to. And it's such a shame, because there are places that can help them, but they've never felt like that place would ever value them. So, you know, I think we're not doing service to all the GPs if we're not representing all of them, if that makes sense.
No, I agree with that, Zeva, and I think what I would like is to end up in a situation where members flash their membership card with pride and say, hey, look, you know, I'm a member of the RCGP. And it should be something said with pride. And it should be like a bar which is set quite high. And it should be something which, you know, like I know certain members of different colleges, you know, like, you know, Royal College of Surgeons and Royal College of Pediatrics, you know, child and pediatric, you know, they're a lot of the people I speak to from those colleges are really proud to be members of an organization which they feel reflects them as doctors and professionals and really sticks up for them. And, you know, hopefully, I mean, we are the biggest college. Evie, you'll probably correct me if I'm wrong, 50,000 plus members, one of the biggest Royal Colleges out there. Yet, you know, we need to ensure that people who are our members really do feel that sense of achievement and pride and want to remain members of the college moving forwards. And that's where I want to be.
Strictly speaking, I'm not from a widening participation background. However, my parents could never afford to send me to a private school or get me a tutor. So I was always I was kind of the bright child in a comprehensive school, but the comprehensive school was one that had, I don't know, 30% A to C. And hence the bullying and, you know, I'm brown and et cetera, white, kind of in a white predominant area. So I couldn't afford to go to, courses to help me get into medicine or anything like that. And I suppose I had one interview, one offer, I got in. There was lots of things I'd done not so good, which I learned from, and I went back to the schools that I studied in to try and help students from that really wanted to explore careers in the NHS and medicine to consider a career. And I would sort of, I wouldn't necessarily, you can call it mentoring, you know, help them a little bit with their applications and personal statements, and a few of them got into medical school as well. So I feel like if you do one good thing for somebody else, from the kind of experiences that you've had, that can definitely help somebody else. So, you know, everything that Mellon Medics are doing, all of that kind of, that project that they're working on is still valid today. So in comparison to when I was applying for medicine, there are a lot more free resources, but again, you need someone to tell you where those free resources are. You know, it's pointless to necessarily expect, people from, kind of, backgrounds where, for example, they don't even have the encouragement necessarily to go into college or university. to be able to necessarily find all of that themselves, but many do. You know, there are lots of people in my year group who, you know, their parents were, I think, taxi drivers, and they're kind of orthopedic surgeons now. So it does happen, but I think all of us have a bigger role to play, because I'm sure you guys understand the concept social mobility. So, you know, for us to move our country along, we need to mobilize people from the kind of poor represented backgrounds and help them into careers like kind of medicine and things. You know, the experiences that these people have are challenging experiences. You know, there are some people who I've seen become doctors who are refugees, some people who have come across some really, really difficult kind of circumstances, you know, people who've been from, you know, backgrounds that they've been abused and things like that. And I think if people don't understand the concept of well-being from, I wouldn't even say from medical school, it needs to be from school, you know, I would argue probably from primary school, that's when people need to really think about well-being, you know, and I feel like because well-being has become slightly trendy now, it probably is to some extent being implemented in lower school. But I think if people aren't aware from a younger age, especially in this age of kind of mental health problems are rife, you know, eating disorders in children, I have never seen so many children with eating disorders as I have in the last couple of years. You know, these are problems. These problems don't come out of nowhere. They come out of the way people have been brought up, the way people have been, you know, as I suppose I speak as a South Asian person, I know lots of people from the South Asian community have an eating disorder, and primarily that's because of the pressure that they're put under. So, for example, their parents might be people that want them to become a doctor tomorrow or something like that. And they put themselves under so much pressure to do something that their parents want them to do. You know, if you don't understand that about a South Asian person, you don't understand that about someone from the Black community or from any other community, you know, that is going to affect their well-being. And that's going to affect how much you can help their well-being as well. So 100% well-being needs to be, I think, in mainstream school education from the beginning. And I think there need to be kind of, as a GP, I've seen this, more accessible ways for people from lower kind of from primary schools, from secondary schools, to be able to access mental health help as well, because I think if we don't get the structure right from the foundation, you know, what we're dealing with on the surface is it's nothing. We're just kind of mopping it up really at the top.
Yeah, I really agree with you, Zeva, that things should start from primary school, and maybe there'd even be a focus on helping parents understand well-being in their children, without being patronising if there's a way to do that. But I think a recurring theme that you see with people who struggle with anxiety, depression, various mental health conditions, a recurring theme that I've noticed as a GP is often they've had very critical backgrounds. So criticism from young age, suffering abuse, those sorts of things, and not having the resources to be able to know that they're okay, no matter what someone's saying to them, that they're all right in themselves from a young age. So that sort of thing, those sorts of basic supportive things are needed, not just for the people who are identified by MASH and the safeguarding. It's needed by people who are just your everyday kids who are falling out through the net, who are suffering at home, neglect, criticism, all those sorts of things. Like you've mentioned, Zeva, people who are being almost forced into doing certain careers or ways of living and living up to certain standards and not being given the whole kind of wishy-washy middle class, you're wonderful, absolutely exceptional speech that a lot of children get. But actually the vast majority of kids probably don't get that. They probably get the opposite from their parents or their caregivers, whoever's at home for them. So I think it's such a wide issue. And if we started from very young and supporting not just children, but their families as well, to really understand where feelings of self-worth things come from, then I think that might have a positive impact, as long as it was able to be done, like I said, without patronising people or irritating them. Because you don't want to get punched in the face either. So, and I could easily see myself being punched in the face for that. So, but it's from a place of, you know, it's from a personal experience as well. Like, I love my parents. They had absolutely no idea that putting certain sort of pressures on me or my siblings would have an impact later on that was quite profound, actually. But I think, you know, by things like, you know, really pushing for medicine and that sort of thing, I did choose medicine after doing work experience as a primary school teacher and work experience in law, and then work experience in A&E, and then kicking myself when I absolutely loved A&E above everything else, because then I fell for the medicine which my family wanted me to do anyway. But you know, that pressure, it does have an impact on how you see yourself and the things that you think you need to do to be able to be loved. And I think those sorts of conversations need to be had with everybody and not just the ones who are really, really kind of visibly struggling or in abusive homes. Like, it can happen to anyone. And I joked about middle class, but you can get it at any social level, those kinds of pressures. Sometimes even more from your kind of like even sort of more affluent backgrounds without people realizing what's happening there. So I don't know if you guys want to add to that at all, but yeah, well-being from a young age would be great.
Well-being shouldn't be an additional or optional extra. It shouldn't be like a bolt-on. It should be part of the basic strand that runs through all education from the beginning through to medical school, through your training. And, you know, like you both say, it never even mentioned, was it, when we were at, you know, school or medical school or through our training. It was just something, you know, you expected to kind of just get on with it, stiff upper lip kind of approach, which we all know doesn't work. I'm not going to bore you with stories from many years ago from my childhood. It's a completely different ball game where I come from, so I think the less said about that, the better. But I think, yeah, it starts from the beginning, from parenting, positivity, and just really encouraging kids to try and be the best they can, whether they go into this career, that career, whatever, you know, just being there for them and that genuine, you know, support and love, no strings attached. You know, it doesn't matter whether you become a doctor or, you know, whatever it is, that should be there for your children no matter what. And when I was growing up, it was completely different.
Do you know, the struggle is, no matter what we say to people, there will be people out there who are like, well, if my child doesn't become this or that, like a lawyer or something like that, they're not going to feel like they can like unconditionally love their child. Unfortunately, that is the truth for some people and some family setups. So I think a good thing to do would be to teach like children about self-worth and things from a young age as well. I think that could be helpful for well-being. And also things like teaching from fairly young about alcohol and that sort of thing, and noticing when you're having too much, or like relying on substances or to like calm down, noticing when you're starting to have behaviours that show that something might be going wrong. Basic things like being able to recognise that if your house is going messier and messier, that might be a signal that something's wrong, or checking in on your friends, like what to do if you notice those sorts of things in your friends or in yourself. Who can you go to for support? What do you do if you go to your GP for support but they're actually really bad at talking to you about it and make you feel uncomfortable? Because, you know, there are options there, but people might not realize that you can go for a second opinion, or you could go directly to a psychologist. Or, you know, people don't have the same knowledge that we have as GPs, because we've been studying it for 5 years or more, and then we've had our 3 years of our specialist training, and then we've had all the years of experience. Things that we take for granted as knowledge, like Zerva said, people won't know exactly where to go and get the free information. They won't know where to type in depression NHS into Google and they'll get loads of really good information. They won't know where to find that stuff. So I guess there is an onus on us to spread that knowledge to people, especially the ones who won't naturally find it. It's been an interesting journey this year. especially this year. I started social media ages ago, like a couple of years ago, but it did really sort of get much more sort of like become a bigger part of my day-to-day life for the whole of the last year. I recently took a bit of a break from it, from doing regular posting, just to give myself a little bit of well-being self-care time as well, because if you do it too much, it does sort of feed into any issues that you have. So I struggle a bit with anxiety, and I noticed that kind of flared up, and the first thing that I did was kind of take a step back, mostly from social media, and that really helped actually. Now I feel refreshed and can post more. But content takes a lot of time, and I think even a post that you don't think may have, like, it looks like it might have been done very quickly, could have taken anything up to 8 hours to make, maybe even longer. And when you think about what you're doing in GP land through the week and all your kind of home commitments as well, it can take a long time to do these things. So I've just been, especially in recent months, been working out strategies to make content much quicker and still informative, and also starting to link in more of the NHS website info rather than trying to rewrite it myself, because there are actually inherent issues with doing that. You take on certain risks if you write about certain illnesses and things without the backing that things like websites like the NHS websites have, or Patient UK have, like legal teams and things. So yeah, it's been a massive learning journey. But the main thing about social media has been meeting peers and friends such as Zev, actually. It's nice to meet you, Carter, as well now. But it's just such a wonderful platform for meeting people. I know me and Zev have like chatted on the phone a couple of times. We've done collaborations on the internet, and we've never met in person yet. But I feel like I know what Zev is about, and I'm sure she kind of, you might feel that you know what I'm about as a person. And I really feel like I've found my tribe of people who feel the same way about the world, or very similar to the world, about the world that I do. And it's often difficult to find that in your like everyday, day-to-day life, especially with the way that we're living at the moment. So that's been my favourite bit, is making friendships and chatting, collaborating. It's been wonderful. Mushy, mushy. Very mushy stuff there. But it's true. How about you guys? How have you found social media has kind of impacted on you?
So my social media experience is Instagram, which I, because Tash and me have met mainly on Instagram. So Carter, I think you're more on Twitter, aren't you?
Yeah, I mean, I use different things for different purposes. For me, Twitter is much more kind of work orientated, kind of official. And my Instagram is just about my foolery and running around and my running and, you know, and weekends and things. And it's very different. It's very social. Same as Facebook, really. But yeah, Twitter is more my platform for work.
Because I historically have been very sort of anti-social media for anything more than just kind of a private page that you share with your family members. So I've been on, obviously, Facebook for forever, and then Instagram privately for, I think, 3 or 4 years. I actually left Twitter a long time ago because I felt everyone has verbal diarrhea on Twitter. Whenever there's anything going on in the world, it's like everyone has an opinion on it, and everybody feels like they need to share that opinion, but they don't always think about the repercussions of what they're actually saying. And I suppose I didn't have the mechanisms to be able to like filter out the stuff or be able to manage my emotions when I was reading certain things. So the only way I dealt with it was actually just by leaving Twitter, and I had those very strict boundaries. I suppose when COVID came along, we weren't able to see each other. We weren't able to go and see our family and friends and things. And, you know, I'm from a very sociable South Asian background. You know, every weekend we always had something on. So for me to go from that to nothing, like I needed something else to do. And it kind of coincided with all the misinformation that was spreading around COVID and stuff like that, you know, so easily accessible through WhatsApp. And I don't know why I kind of felt like a moral responsibility to like kind of shun all of that out, and that was the intention that I came onto social media with. But you know, I didn't realize, for example, the effort that's taken into content creation, and that is essentially what it becomes when it becomes a bit like a job, really. It's just another it's another thing that you do on the side, apart from you don't really get paid for it. So it's a lot more voluntary time, you know, unless you get PR sponsorships and all that kind of thing. But you know, apart from that, it's all your own goodwill. So it is actually really difficult to try and get the balance. You know, if you put your everything into your social media and everything into kind of what you're producing on social media, because there are responsibilities that we all take, you know, we all take risks by that, you know, everything that we say on social media, we are accountable for. So we have to make sure everything that we put across there, you know, it's representing us, it's representing our profession. There is quite a lot of pressure on it. So I can see why a lot of people don't do it. But equally, I've always been an advocate that we need to have doctors on there just like you'll have people spreading misinformation, you need to have people that are spreading correct information. And there are, I didn't realize this, there are genuinely some people that will log on to Instagram before they'll even go onto Google to search something, because they would trust some of the information that they would see on social media before, you know, actually thinking, okay, maybe I should actually just Google this or look this up on the NHS website. So it's good to have that in the mix of everything else. But yeah, it does eat into your kind of personal time. You know, I have a son, I have a family. Now lockdown restrictions are easing. I most certainly do not have that amount of time as I did at the beginning of the pandemic, which is okay. But, you know, like Tesh mentioned, you know, there are, you know, friendships and relationships and networking that I've done. You know, I've met some people in our profession I would never, ever have dreamt of meeting from living in this really odd part of the West Midlands. And, you know, there's people in London, I know people in Scotland, I know people in Northern Ireland, you know, I know people across the world. And, you know, we can all have a chat together in one forum. So that's kind of been the beauty of it. One thing that really helps me, I suppose, in linking it back to well-being, is really reflecting on what your intentions are with using social media. So if your intentions are good and you are there to just try and help people and spread correct information and kind of an image of being a doctor that is just we are humans as well, I don't think there's any harm in that. But I think it's, I have to regularly remind myself of that for sure.
Yeah, I think there's a tendency for people to assume that if you go on it and you have like a page that's like taking off or has quite a lot of followers or something like that, that you're fame hungry or that that's what you're there for. And that was actually, that fed into why I became anxious about social media a little while back, because someone made a joke about me being a fame monster and I thought that's not what I want at all. Like I watched some of the famous GPs like Poonam, Krishan and Amit and everyone, like they're just so fabulous when I see them on TV, and it would be fun, but I just couldn't imagine that, you know, that's not, maybe at some point you, like, I wanted that. And then I thought, nah, I quite like just putting some info, chatting to friends, like that means a lot more. And now it just seems a little bit daunting, all that sort of thing. So it is interesting, you know, it can be a bit of a journey, that there is always that little bit of that dopamine reward bit of your brain that is, it does, you know, kind of fire off if you start increasing followers or you get lots of kind of positive commentary on your posts and things, then it does become a little bit addictive. And we know that that is linked to, you know, primal things in our brain. So you have to be careful with that stuff. Even, you know, as a ripe old GP, it can still affect you. So you've got to be careful. And that's what I've been like trying to learn to do, is just to be careful and not get sucked in by the dopamine, and then not try to replace that with chocolate, but just, you know, try and just do healthier things instead. Take some space and then go back to it when you're ready, but never ever lose those kind of lovely friendships that you're making on the side, because you know some of them are really quite genuine things, and that's nice. Carter, do you have anything to add as well from the
test? You kind of hit all the nails on the head there, really. And I think that, you know, like Zerva said, you know, the Twitter sphere can be quite toxic in equal measure to how positive it can be. And, you know, if anyone's got an opinion, it's polarized significantly. And, you know, you could say my favorite color is blue, and you'll have 10 people queuing up to say, how dare you? It should be red or yellow. You know, it's just, it can spiral out of all control. And then, you know, you've got all of the kind of negative aspects of social media where, you know, trolling and things like that, where if you don't have a thick skin, or if you haven't got the coping mechanisms to be able to cope with that or exit the arena if it becomes too much, it can be really, really negative for your mental health. And I think that, you know, from my own experiences, I wasn't on Twitter until I started campaigning for the presidency of the RCGP about 3 years ago. And it was a very steep learning curve. Content creation, people's reactions to you, people's interpretation of what you represent. It was just a minefield. And although I went on it as a means to an end, you know, I became kind of like very fond of social media from that connectivity point of view, meeting people with similar viewpoints to yourself and really kind of connecting with people who you wouldn't normally have the opportunity to connect with. So for me, I think it's a positive thing when used in the right way, as with most things in life. And never say anything on social media which you wouldn't say in an interview to the BBC or in the Daily Mail. You know, that's how I live it. And if you, you know, stick by that, you should pretty much, you know, go in the right direction and not bump into too much trouble.
I mean, I've learned from our conversation that you can go to the RCGP to talk about things that you want lobbied. And I know that that should be natural to know that, but it's incredible how sometimes the most obvious resources available to you are things you overlook. And of course, you know, I'm volunteering for a charity, UOK.org, which supports doctors who, with, you know, looking after their well-being and mental health. And you wouldn't know about it if not for me plugging it. So, or like seeing it on the BBC, for example, last week and that sort of thing. So that's my exciting take home, that even if you feel alone, there are so many other resources available to you. You just have to ask.
So my take home is that kind of well-being, although I don't really like it as a phrase, I think what it means, it's where you start to put yourself first. So, you know, we need to look beyond what we do day to day. We need to look beyond being just doctors and looking after patients, which, like Carter mentioned earlier on, we should still continue to do, but not at the cost of our own happiness and our own mental health. I think self-awareness, self-worth is something that we all deserve to have and we all deserve to build on. And there are so many ways that we can do that. We have learned through here that there are charities like UOK Doc, Doctors in Distress, etc. Through our own work, we've got kind of the NHS Practitioner Health. You know, for example, some of the work that I do through the British Islamic Medical Association, you know, there are faith-based support systems as well for people from different faiths. And I think, you know, depending on what you feel comfortable with, you need to, you know, don't hesitate to reach out to that. And if you don't know where to get those resources, feel free to connect with someone. You know, one of the things that I'm trying to do as part of the British Islamic Medical Association and my hat as RCGP College tutor is try and bridge a gap there, because we have so many Muslim patients, we have so many Muslim doctors, and there are unique needs of people from different faiths and different backgrounds. And I don't think that's something that we should ignore. I think that's something that as a faculty, we should facilitate. And I think if there are means to do that, we should continue to do that. But also just kind of look out for each other. And there is more to your life than your work. And that's OK as well.
We are experts in looking after patients, putting other people first. That's what our job is. That's what our lifestyle is all about. You know, if we cut a GP in half, like a stick of Blackpool rock, it would say, you know, serve others, look after others. You know, it's ingrained within us. And I think that the time has come now where situations, you know, and the environments have become quite challenging, quite tough. And the spotlight has definitely been shone on those inequities, inequalities in the system, in society at large, and also within general practice. And it's never been more important than to, you know, look after yourself, take time out to really nurture your interests, your hobbies, spend time with significant others. In the pandemic, we've sacrificed so much and lost so many near and dear to ourselves, and we really need to reflect on that and just, you know, squeeze the last drop of juice out of every single minute of life and live in the present and really start to care for ourselves, because unless we care for ourselves, we can't look after and care for others or our patients.
Huge thanks to all of our guests this episode for their very personal takes on well-being. You can find Tesh on Instagram at dr.tesh and Server at drzerva. Carter is on Twitter at drcartersingh and the links are in the show notes below. Head to our wellbeing pages at rcgp.org.uk/wellbeing for a wealth of resources, both for individuals and the wider practice team, including practical tips to support your wellbeing, as well as a list of other organisations providing guidance and support. If you need urgent support, or if you've been affected by anything mentioned in this episode, please text NHSPH to 85258, available 24 hours a day. Links to everything mentioned during the episode can be found in the notes below, as always. Until next time, thanks for listening.